Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Claire Hoffman. She's the author of the memoir Greetings from Utopia Park and a journalist reporting for national magazines on culture, religion, celebrity, business, and more. She was formerly a staff reporter for the LA Times and Rolling Stone. She's a graduate of UC Santa Cruz and has an MA in religion from the University of Chicago and an MA in journalism from Columbia University. She serves on the boards of the Columbia School of Journalism, ProPublica, and the Brooklyn Public Library, and her new book is Sister Sinner, The Miraculous Life and Mysterious Disappearance of Amy Semple McPherson. Here's Claire Hoffman now. It is so good to have Claire Hoffman with me on the show today. This is going to be such an interesting conversation. It's going to tap into a lot of different things, a lot of different groups, but also this one in particular that I can't wait to talk about, that I remember hearing about while growing up here in Los Angeles with this mythical creature that happened to be real, but also there's so much mythology around her that sounds like she really knew how to cultivate, which is fascinating to me because we see that a lot. And we can see that it isn't necessarily just these modern techniques, but that they've been around a while and they're tried and true. And so I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself and then we'll start chatting.
Thank you so much, Rachel. My name is Claire Hoffman and I'm a journalist and a writer. I wrote my first book about the Transcendental Meditation movement that I grew up in, and it's kind of an investigation and also a memoir about that experience in Iowa. And then this is my second book, which is about Amy Semple McPherson, and it traces her rise to fame and then this incredible scandal that happened in 1926 Los Angeles. Yeah, even though those two stories seem totally unrelated, there's a relationship there that I'm excited to talk about with you, Rachel.
Oh, I'm excited about that too. You just don't know how your own experiences are going to guide you, navigate a certain path for you in so many ways. So I'm wondering, with your upbringing, with your exposure to a particular group, and I think also learning about groups because of it and learning about leaders, and it's an interesting education that you lived. And so if you can spend a few moments just talking about your own history, that's not your whole history, that's a part of it. And so you're welcome to talk about your family of origin and where you grew up. And I think for people to really get to know you, and then we'll start talking a little bit more about this path that you took.
Yeah, I mean, where to begin? My parents met in the 70s in a meditation retreat in Riverside, California. They were both practitioners of the Transcendental Meditation Technique and followers of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who had become famous from the Beatles. And they met and fell in love and pretty quickly got pregnant with my brother. And they had a rocky relationship. And my father was an alcoholic. And at some point, my mom sort of answered the call that Maharishi had put out for his real devotees and followers to move to this very tiny town in the Midwest called Fairfield, Iowa. And he had this complex mathematical theory about how these advanced forms of meditation would create world peace. And so we moved to Iowa in 1983 from New York City, just the three of us, my mom, my brother, and I. And I grew up there. I went to the Maharishi School of the Age of Enlightenment. My meditations were graded. Most people in my life were meditating 3 to 4 hours a day. I was supposed to be meditating 10 to 20 minutes a day. And a lot of our education was based on Maharishi's teachings. So all of which is to say, I left when I was 17. I wrote a whole book about this. I left when I was 17. I went to college, and right away, I just was like really interested in religion. I took a class on born-again Christianity when I was a sophomore in college that like actually changed my life. And I was really initially always very interested in Pentecostalism because I think there were aspects of Pentecostalism that really reminded me of some of these advanced techniques that we were doing in TM, which are also kind of bodily and wild. The speaking in tongues and this feeling of being taken over by some outside spirit. So I always was interested, like remembering being in Fairfield when I was in college and leaving the campus where I grew up, which was totally based on meditation and Hinduism, to go to this towny church to just go look. And my mom was so freaked out. She was like, what are you doing? Why are you going? It's like the worst thing ever to her. But yeah, and so I studied journalism and I went to divinity school and I just kept having this fascination with born again Christianity, with fundamentalism, with all religious intense lived belief, I would say. But I have had a career working in newspapers and magazines. I did a lot of coverage. Like I worked for Rolling Stone and I did a lot of celebrity profiles and also covered the world of celebrity. But I felt like there was also this real overlap with power and fame and what celebrity does to people and that relationship between fans and celebrities. All of which is to say, when I found out about Amy Semple McPherson, I used to drive by her Angelus Temple on the way to work at the LA Times. And I was like, what is that place? Like, it's gigantic. It looks like the Colosseum. It's just this huge thing. So Amy had all of these threads coming together. That's my very long answer.
Okay. To go back to something you said about having this bodily experience and being transported, having something that feels transcendent, that makes you feel connected to something else. For a lot of people who I've talked to who have had those experiences, there was something that felt very powerful about it, that felt awe-inspiring, that added to their fervor to it because it could feel there's something addictive about reaching that point. And I remember two clients of mine talking about how it made them feel not alone, which was interesting, like they were connected. So there is something, I think, intoxicating about that. And you can get very tied in to an organization or to a person or to a belief that helps you have that feeling, similar to a drug, which is interesting. And so I understand the pull of that and the appeal of that.
There's two things there. I mean, first of all, I always say, like, I'm very interested in the intermediaries, the people who can take us to those places, whether that's at a concert where a performer or like an actress or a singer can truly transport you to another world, or whether that's a guru or a religious teacher or a preacher who can somehow transport you even physically to this other world. And what happens to those intermediaries? I just love it. And the other thing I would say about that kind of addictive experience is that I think that my understanding is that charismatic Christianity, Pentecostalism, is the fastest growing religion in the world. There are over 600 million people who fall under that umbrella at this point. And I see it there, and I see it even in like New Age communities, people I know who've gotten into Kundalini or even ayahuasca, these things where it is about having this transportive experience physically as part of their spirituality that is just somehow becoming more important.
Very interesting. And I think about when we hear about different traditions, and I'm thinking of the whirling dervishes too in my mind, that there is something about when you do this repetitive movement and you can then get into a different headspace and not feel dizzy because there is something else happening there that's motivating you or that feels like it's at your core suddenly. And how I think a lot of people will have a hard time leaving that. And sometimes these people who've had that experience then go shopping for having it again, even if it comes in a slightly different form. Is that something you've noticed?
Yeah, because I live in California and because of where I grew up, I feel like a lot of the people that I interact with are more in the category of falling into New Age thought or psychedelic-based religion. Yeah, I can't help just having lived through everything I lived through of noticing the swap out in language. Oh, you traded this vocabulary for that vocabulary. Or the desire always to categorize the world between good and bad. It is surprising to me, even though I see it all the time, that people do switch out. And I'm not acting like I'm not human and I don't do that. It is interesting to watch the language stuff. I kind of nerd out on language.
It's a good thing, I think, to nerd out on because it has such an impact on us and language is so influential. It sometimes dictates our experience and what we think we're feeling and what we think we're experiencing. And what's interesting about that, too, is that if you are having some sort of psychedelic journey, I think depending on your own way of looking at it or who you're with and how they're guiding you, it can be told to you that that's God when someone else would say that the tree's talking or whatever. But I think you're open to receiving that interpretation and that becomes, I think, part of your vision. So I think sometimes people think they're having their own very personal experience, but they are being influenced during it, which is interesting.
Of course. I mean, they have all these guides and there's so much coaching now around a lot of these experiences. I lived for almost four years in a small town in Costa Rica, partially during the pandemic and beforehand, where it was like the ratio of life coaches was incredibly high. But they're all espousing different doctrines that they think is so liberated and different than traditional religion, but it often follows the same rubric.
Oh, yeah. Costa Rica is a hotbed.
Yeah, we could talk about Costa Rica a different time because it's a whole thing.
Okay. So here you're driving to the LA Times building, which is a cool building in downtown LA. It's great that you got to work there. And here you're passing by this humongous place that feels mysterious. So tell me what happened. So you started doing the deep dive into Amy?
Honestly, it was years, probably a decade before I did do that. It kept coming around. You know, I'd heard about her in divinity school. I went to divinity school in Chicago before I moved to LA to work as a reporter, just like a professional master's degree in the hopes of writing about religion. And, you know, I knew that she had been a very important, influential early evangelical leader, but I didn't realize, oh my gosh, look at this building. But at some point, shortly after I had published my first book, I was really into ocean swimming. I still am, but I learned that she had disappeared while ocean swimming. And I was like, wait, that's crazy. She was swimming alone in the Pacific in 1926 as this incredibly famous woman by herself. That alone shocked me. Like, I never go alone, too nervous about sharks and always like to have a friend who would get eaten first. a super good friend.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, it tells you everything you need to know about me. I'm like,
just in case any of your friends are listening.
Exactly. I'm like, never to swim with me again.
I don't have to run fast. I just have to run faster than the next person.
Yeah, that's my swimming style. Yes, like a survivor. I learned that and I was like, wait, I have to learn more. And that's when I started to take a deep dive. At first, I was like, oh, there's lots of books about her. There's a couple of books that were written 30 years ago. There's a book that was written 50 years ago. There was a book that was written at the time that she was living, like in the 1930s. So I bought all of them and I started reading them. And right away, I just had this sense, people are not treating her correctly, I would say. So the book in the 1930s was written by a female journalist who seems to be excellent. She did great research and investigation, but her disdain for Amy Semple McPherson, she can't write a sentence without like condemning her for being a hypocrite or a fraud. And then flash forward to the books from the 60s, they're very melodramatic, Valley of the Dolls, very over the top. In the 90s, there was a book written by a woman who was a evangelical and a professor, and it's great research. Again, this disappearance and kidnapping episode is like a paragraph. I was like, well, that's weird. I just felt like everyone was seeing what they wanted to see with her, and she was such a wonderfully complicated figure. It's like, are all these things actually true? You know, is she incredibly melodramatic and a total hypocrite, and also like a really important, ambitious female leader of the 20th century that should be totally included when we learn history? Why is she not included? She's so important and did so many great things, but also did some really wild stuff. So then I was kind of in.
And I wonder also how much she's not really given credence because she's a woman, because that certainly has happened throughout our history and continues to happen.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I just love her story and in some ways her is, I think a lot of male leaders have been allowed to have this good and bad side. If you go see Hamilton, he has an affair and cheats on his wife and his son ends up getting killed because of him, right? But he's a hero. And with Amy, it was like, okay, she did something pretty crazy and potentially very hypocritical and selfish, but she also, you know, fed a million Angelenos during the Great Depression for years. She really believed what she believed. I wanted to put my arms around that as best I could. And I should say, like, also, just because we were talking about my background, I was really interested to see what a female leader who was charismatic and who had this charisma and pull with followers looked like. I kind of felt like I knew the male story and I wanted to see how does it work when it's a woman. So that was a big part of it.
That's interesting because I do try to give equal time to female cult leaders too on the show because there have been a number of them, but they're sometimes not talked about as much. And there are also are not as many. But the Elizabeth Clare prophets, who, from what I have seen and from what I have learned from people who were in her group, she wasn't doing good things for people. She wasn't benevolent. She was just taking people over and taking them off course. I mean, the person who started Christian Science and the church that's still there in Boston. It is amazing to see that, yes, there were these women who were influential, some for good reason, some bad, some were famous, some infamous, and somewhere in between. So I'm curious about her. And when you're saying that she did some really good things, and then she also, there's some really wild things, just so we give her her fair due. So she was feeding people during the Depression. What else was she doing?
I mean, I could back up a little if you want and tell you her quick biography.
Great.
So Amy was born in Canada in 1890 to a teenage mother in relative working class poverty, rural Canada. And her mother was a member of the Salvation Army, which was a new religious movement at that time. And her mother had like a real kind of radical faith. And as soon as Amy was born, she was like, this girl is prophesied by God. I ended up getting pregnant, but this girl will be an evangelizer for God. So right away, there was this thing with Amy and her mother, this dynamic of this child is chosen. She was an only child, and she grew up in this little farm. She grew up in London, in Ontario, Canada. And right away, she was kind of bossy, headstrong, a leader in school. There's these stories that she would tell herself about being made fun of for being part of the Salvation Army. And then she would quickly get all the kids who'd been making fun of her to pick up little instruments and make a Salvation Army band until they were all doing the Salvation Army things. So she just always had this charisma and power. She was an actress in high school and an elocutionist, which like I weirdly can never say. I can't. It's like, I can't elocute that. And she felt that as she was getting into school dances and music, that she was moving away from God. And one night in, I would say, 1908 or 1907, actually, she was 17 years old. She has her father stop at a small church and look inside, and there are holy rollers inside. And this is like a new idea that's just happened. I mean, the Azusa Street revivals were just a couple years before. She goes in, and there's this incredibly handsome Irish preacher who is preaching a Pentecostal gospel, and she is like struck. She's madly in love with him and totally wants to have this experience of being connected to Jesus, a living God, and speaking in tongues. I will fast forward and just say she converts, she becomes his wife, they go to China, she's a missionary, he dies, and she just has this sense of being called, but has a lot of hardship. She goes through another husband, two kids. She tries to be a housewife in Rhode Island, and it kind of all falls apart. She just is like too intense for staying home with the kids and cleaning the floors. And one night in the hospital, she's like had a hysterectomy, and she hears the voice of God and is like basically tells her to leave her husband and go be an evangelist. So she packs up the kids, disappears, and ultimately ends up traveling with her mother around the country in a car with the kids preaching, which was really unusual at the time. It still is to have a lady evangelist. She got attention right away. I think people came initially because she was sort of this freak show phenomenon of like, oh my gosh, there's a woman preaching. And she was like an attractive young woman, but people stayed. She really had staying power, and her gospel was very romantic, very much love-filled. And also, you know, she did divine healings. She spoke in tongues. People were having these big experiences. And she moves to Los Angeles in 1918. And within 5 years, with the help of her mother, she builds the Angelus Temple, which is considered the first megachurch in America. It had 5,300 seats and often had 10 to 15,000 people coming through in a single day. And she did these huge, showy productions. She would have choreographers and stage directors and costume designers and just really elaborate, she called them illustrated sermons. And it became like a real cultural attraction. She ministered to kind of these newly arrived, largely white, working class new Angelinos who were coming from the Midwest and the South. And yeah, she was incredibly powerful. She was a fundamentalist. She wanted the Bible in the classroom. She wanted people to stop teaching evolution. And in the middle of all this, she's down at Venice Beach on May 18th, 1926, and she walks into the ocean and she disappears. And it's a huge news story. The city is electrified by it. Within days, there's 40,000 people down on the beach praying for her. Two people die looking for her. Yeah, so that is the beginning of the story.
Yeah, and I remember I have cousins who live in Venice, and that also became sort of lore. Like you'd go to the beach and you'd say, I wonder where she walked in. You just remember hearing about these stories and if she was going to be just showing up again somewhere else and if that was going to be her or an embodiment of her. Like it added to her mystery, I think, to the staying power. It's like Amelia Earhart.
Yes. And it had this miraculousness because 35 days later, she walks in from the desert of Mexico in a white dress, wearing a corset and pretty much unharmed, and has this crazy story, but it feels like a resurrection. It's very dramatic. And she had definitely been very famous in Los Angeles, somewhat nationally known, but now she's in newspapers all over the world. The story of a lady evangelist who disappeared into the ocean and is resurrected 35 days later. She was like catnip. The press just went crazy for it, and her fame was just gargantuan. And she came back to Los Angeles after emerging from the desert. And there was a grand jury investigation initially to find the kidnappers, but very quickly it becomes an investigation of her.
Right. I mean, when you hear about the fact, like you were saying, that if you were to swim in the ocean, you'd bring someone, or even maybe not for the right reason. But here she was by herself. So did she disappear into the ocean? There are no witnesses to say it, or there are probably people who jumped in to say they had seen it because they wanted to be part of the story. So you just never know what actually happened and if it even happened.
Yeah, there's two versions of the story. There's Amy's version, which is that she had already gone for a swim that day and she came back in and she was at the water's edge when she was approached by two people who said they wanted her to come pray for their sick baby who was in a car idling just right nearby on Venice Beach. And she walked to the car to help them. She had tried to go get her things because she was in a swimsuit. And they're like, no, no, you have to come quick. She goes, they open the car door. She thinks she's going to see the baby. And instead, there's chemicals put over her mouth and she's knocked out and she wakes up chained to a bed and is held for, 35 days. The other version of events is that she sent her assistant away and took off with her alleged lover, who was her radio operator. His name was Kenneth Ormiston, who is a recent divorcee and kind of a ladies' man. And they drove up to Carmel by the Sea to a love shack where there were multiple witnesses who say they saw them along the route and living up there where she was in disguise.
Incredible.
Yeah.
What is the story that she tells?
She says that she was held by these people named a woman named Mexicali Rose, which was also a hit song at the time, a guy named Philippe, and that they were going to sell her into white slavery, her words, in Mexico by some kind of kingpin. And she was moved once to Mexicali, I believe. What is that? But she's moved to a shack in the desert that had a wood floor and a bathroom. And she's held there for a while with Mexicali Rose, who goes out one day to get groceries. And Amy takes the ropes that are around her wrist and saws them off on a serrated edge of a maple syrup can, climbs out the window and runs, I don't know, something like 20 miles through the desert, through day and into the night until she reaches this border town. I will say she never changed her story. She lived for another almost 20 years. There were like a few kind of wrinkles at the beginning that the cops were like, wait, I thought you said you were picked up here and not here. But otherwise, she told that story just the same.
Mexicali. So I think that's considered Baja, right?
Yeah.
But then she's placed in a lot of different places.
Yeah. I mean, there's witnesses who see her in Santa Barbara, in Salinas. There's a lot of people who see her in Tucson just before she reemerges, and maybe with the handyman from the church who's kind of her fixer, and fairly reputable people. Like there was a guy who's the buildings inspector from Tucson who's like, I saw you on the street last week. I'm going to stake my life on it. And two doctors who said that she ducked behind a car when they were looking at her. So it becomes this battle. In Los Angeles in 1926, I mean, I think what's interesting is that it becomes this big question about faith right away. As soon as she comes back, she's asking people, do you believe me? Do you believe me? If you love me, you will believe me. And she even says wild things like either what I say is true and I am good, or what I say is not true and I'm the worst sinner in the world. It gets elevated to these big questions. And the establishment churches in Los Angeles at the time hate her. They're like, get this lady off the stage. She is destroying the reputation of the city. Los Angeles is in the process of trying to get the Olympics in town. And the powers that be are like, please make this woman stop talking. So she kind of has enemies all around. I'm telling you this kind of like absurd aspects of it, sort of my conclusion that she did fake it. But at the same time, the people who were prosecuting her were awful also. They are going through her underwear and talking about her ankle size and her hair and how she tried to be alluring. Like, she wasn't allowed to be powerful. So in a way, it actually became this campaign to tear down a powerful woman, which you feel this sort of knee-jerk reaction of defense. Don't do that. But on the other hand, it's like maybe she actually took off for 2 weeks with her lover. And why did she have to make up this crazy story?
Right. It's an interesting thing of jumping into this idea of concurrent truths. So they don't have to be at odds with each other. It could be that she made it up, and it could be because she is theatrical and understands how to put together a show and how to conjure up a certain kind of emotion, that she might do that for herself and know how to do it and know how to sustain it just long enough to make sure people remain interested, but not too long where they might forget. I mean, if there's an interesting timing here where kind of a long enough, but still short, she wasn't gone for years and years, where she would have been history. So I think that what is interesting is also that, as you're saying, the people who were antagonistic towards her were these awful people who were being terribly misogynistic and cruel and needing to play on the fact that she might have been seen as sexy, which somehow would make her not trustworthy and believable, which has been an issue and still remains an issue within the legal system. Both and. It definitely draws you in.
Yeah. And it is like this amazing moment too, where as I started researching it, I was like, oh, this is funny. Like 1926, you could be incredibly famous and think you could disappear. It seems like this last moment where she thought that she could do this. She thought she could give her version of reality. I believe that she came to believe it. I think she told herself that story so many times that she believed it. The evidence is kind of overwhelming, honestly, just from a journalistic perspective, that she was not kidnapped. There's just so much evidence. But I think it is what you're saying, like she had had this incredible success and long history as we were talking about, like an intermediary and a translator for the unknown. She was a conjurer. She would tell these stories and interpret these experiences. When people are speaking in tongues, she also had the gift of interpretation. So she could say like, oh, this person is saying this or that. Or, you know, I mean, these miracles where she was healing people. So there was this sense of power, I think, in that way, that she felt like she could somehow do it. It's an incredible story. Not that I'm not saying my book's incredible, like the story of what happened is incredible. The book, you'll have to decide yourself.
We will put a link to in the show notes so people will be able to get it and find it and know where to get it. It's exciting when you're writing a book, when you get into anyone and their history, their personality, you really feel like you jumped into their life and you get to know them so well. And I hear the impact that she had on you and just feeling for her, but also seeing her as someone who was up to things and good things. And she's a showman. So I'm wondering about the whole idea of charisma, because it is so much of what we deal with here on the show, but so much of what we deal with in the world and in politics, the idea of stars. Actually, I was just thinking as an aside, the Lemley family, like the Lemley Theater. So I happen to know some of the Lemleys. I just grew up with them in the community. But I remember hearing about their, well, now great-grandfather, who Carl Lemley, who started Universal. And he had this poster, or developed this idea of this poster for the famous people who were going to be in movies, in his movies. He had their faces with the outline of stars behind them so that they would shine like the stars in the sky. And so the whole idea of famous people being called stars came from this idea of them shining like stars in the sky. You don't think about like, oh, where did that come from? That's an odd thing to call someone a star.
Yeah, I love that.
Right. So here there is this enigmatic, charismatic, mysterious, greater than life-ness to that. And it sticks. And people want to be that, or they want to be with that. And it's so interesting. So let's talk about that. And what about human nature is drawn to it? And that some people are comfortable with having that charisma and using it, and other people are not. I've gotten calls from people who've said, listen, you describe cult leaders. I could be one. People listen to me when I talk, and it actually makes me really uncomfortable. I could be wrong, please.
Yeah.
But there's something about them that is magnetic. Whatever, it happens. And the people who love it and utilize it or abuse it are the ones who have usually the ego need or lack of conscience to go along with it. Anyway, yeah, let's talk about charisma.
For me, the first thing I think of is I grew up in this meditation community. I leave it behind, but I sort of like meditating still. And in my late 20s, I started going to these meditation retreats up in Northern California where they were silent retreats. And you would just meditate. And there was a guy who led them who was kind of a former Buddhist. He called himself Adyashanti. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but it felt like to me listening to him, I felt like, oh, it reminds me of that NPR show with the car mechanics, Click and Clack. He was almost like kind of a religion version of that, very brass tacks. And I was like, oh, okay, this is a way for me to think about this part of my life. This will work for me. I was pretty nihilistic after growing up in the TM movement. But I say all this to say I was on a silent meditation retreat, say there's like 100 people there. And one day he walks in to go up on the stage to give a talk. And a woman walks behind him and falls to the ground and kisses the ground where he walked. And I was like, yep, and I'm out. I'm done. You know, he wasn't asking for that. But there's this moment where it's like, oh, your ground is different than mine. Your touch is power. You have something I want. And that's what I think of when you talk about charisma, is that moment of person walking and then suddenly somebody's kissing the ground or trying to wash their feet, whatever it is.
And for some people, I've noticed too that just like you're saying, he wasn't asking for it in that moment. He wasn't telling everyone to bow down to him. There are people who do garner that kind of adoration and devotion. Sometimes they do it through subtle means where it might not be as obvious, but they do positive reinforcement for people who do those things, like they'll be elevated. So the other people get to see that, and so then they might follow suit. But there are also other people who need to be the person who is falling to the ground and kissing the feet. It's like they need to have someone who they adore to that degree in order to have an anchor, in order to deify someone in their life, then maybe it makes them feel safer or something. So sometimes it's coming from both directions.
Oh, totally. That's like this other piece. I've listened to your show and you hear a lot of stories of abuse and manipulation that are heart-wrenching. And so what I'm about to say, I don't think is that, just to like say that ahead of time. But for example, grew up in the TM movement and I had this real revelation while working on my first book where I was reading this self-published memoir by a woman who said she had an affair with Maharishi, the guru who started the movement. And she recounts a pillow conversation she has with him where he's talking about her starting birth control, wearing certain colors, and also like his ambition maybe to go into politics. And it was so mind-boggling to me. Oh my God, like he was an actual person. He had ambition, and the color thing I got because I grew up being told what colors I could wear and not wear. But the idea of him saying like, oh, maybe I'll go into politics. And also the sense in reading it of his loneliness and alienation, it just really changed it for me where I was like, it reminded me a lot more of these stories that you read about celebrities. I did a story on Justin Bieber, and there's a story from relatively early on in his career where he's locked in his hotel room looking out and he can't go outside for like 3 days because the fans are just having a riot in the parking lot. He's like this, I don't know how old, teenage kid looking out the window and he's trapped. To me, I feel like there is that symbiosis that you see a lot where it's like, certainly there's these leaders who they're stars. They've got the sparkles around their heads and you're drawn to them. And some people like it, some people don't. They all have different ways of dealing with it. Some people take it to crazy ends. Some people walk away. But there's also the piece of it of what it feels like to be caged by it, which is definitely, I should say, like the third section of my book, because Amy has this crazy trial and she emerges victorious, but she is damaged. She starts to have more and more mental breakdowns. She starts using more prescription drugs. She just becomes incredibly fragile. Her health is an issue. She ends up in a conservatorship where her accountant is in charge of her life for the last 7 years of her life. So it's really this cautionary tale in some ways about that relationship.
Oh, yeah. You look at it being something that you wish at times for yourself, if that's your goal, to be adored or to be famous. And then you hear some famous people saying, it's not all it's cracked up to be. Be careful what you wish for. Or it started out nice and then got completely out of control and there were no safeguards and I was trapped in my life, in my house. I think about the celebrities who are planning events and they can't tell anyone, or they need to do something where they like buy the airspace over their house so helicopters can't go over and film. I mean, it's a kind of a crazy thing.
Like an actual cage. And I think you see that with some of these religious figures. Now, some people go to town inside that cage and build out crazy worlds and put other people in cages. So there's incredible abuse that happens within that. But there is a symbiosis between the star and the follower, I would say, that I think is really interesting to think about. And again, I'm not talking about high control abusive relationships, because I kind of put that in a different category. Like, I don't think that's symbiotic. I don't think that.
No, not at all. No, I agree with you there. Absolutely right. I'm wondering also for Amy, who I seem to be on a first name basis with while we're talking.
We all are. Yeah, that everyone was. She had so many lives. She had three husbands too. So you're like, what are we going to do with all these last names?
Yeah, right. Okay. I wonder also, as you get older, and you start noticing maybe that your looks are fading in whatever idealized sense you care about them. Because I do think that as people age, they develop their own beauty in their aging process. But that's not necessarily the case for people who have been able to develop this adoration through their looks to a certain degree. And also, if you develop health issues and you're supposed to be anointed, you're supposed to be above that, what that does to you, because it could be the fame, it could be you, your system breaking down to a certain degree and not being able to have an answer for why that's happening if you have these special powers.
Yeah. For the first one with the looks, after she had this turning point in her life in 1926. If you look at a photograph of her from 1926 and then you look at a photograph of her from 1929, they look like completely different people. Truly, she became obsessed with dieting. She went on an orange juice diet. She got incredibly skinny. She tried to transform her whole body. And again, after reading these trial transcripts where her body is picked apart, it's kind of awful to hear or see. And then she has a facelift in 1930, which I think was a relatively new procedure. She pressures her mother into getting a facelift with her. So that was, again, pretty radical. Brentwood Sanitarium with like a Hungarian doctor.
Okay.
I know, so scary. What you start to read and see in her life in that part is an incredible sense of loneliness. Her third husband just seems like a complete opportunist, kind of a bozo. She's so alienated and removed from the world that It's like only somebody like that who can get in, so to speak. The final years, you feel, on one hand, crazy power. There was at one point where maybe she had preached in person to 10% of the American population, say it was 1933 or something like that. Her reach was incredible. The fact that Billy Graham is a household name and she's not is just truly, honestly, about the scandal and misogyny. But at the same time, she's just having nervous breakdown after nervous breakdown. That's what she would call it, where she had to be like in a dark room for weeks and months at a time. Very dark. It's very Sunset Boulevard, actually. She even had a spider monkey.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That is so similar. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's creepy. I think maybe they might have known about her.
Very gruesome. And so then I wonder about what you come to understand about her drive. Was this something that you think was part of a need, an ego-driven need, or was there something genuine about what she wanted to spread and share, or maybe both? When I think about studying her, I'm thinking also about all these other leaders who I hear about daily and the spectrum and where they fall, and it's everywhere and everywhere in between.
I mean, I think she was a true believer. Absolutely, like to her core, like she absolutely believed that she had been put on this earth to spread the gospel as loudly as possible. She said over and over throughout her life, some version of all I want is the biggest microphone possible to spread the gospel and to be in love. She's like very romantic. Yeah, so I think she was a true believer. I mean, studying her life, there are, if you read the book, there are like these sort of Trumpy aspects, so to speak. She just saw the world the way that she wanted to see it, despite any inputs. She said it was a certain way, and she tried to make the world that way. And it's awe-inspiring for someone who had just been granted the right to vote just like a few years before. Or, I mean, she starts this mega church in 1923, like women in many states still couldn't hold property. And she and her mother are doing this together and they're filing it as a religious institution. Like it's a level of sophistication and let's say manifestation of her ambitions that is incredible to watch. But it also is completely devoid of a sense of common sense or restriction or reality, so to speak. And I think that's what you see. I mean, I think about Maharishi, who I know a lot about. I've reported on Scientology. I've reported on Mormons. These founders just had this incredible, impenetrable sense of self and power in the world, and that their belief was correct and impenetrable. I think that's really contagious, to kind of go back to this charisma question. And I think we're seeing some of this in the world right now. Like somebody is saying that the world is a certain way and people are believing it. And, you know, there's evidence to the contrary. But someone who can hold that space of belief and represent it and articulate it and deliver it to people, sometimes it is, I think, self-reinforcing. If you believe you can fly, maybe you can fly. And there's this power of belief that you see that is really transformative. And I should say, I don't have it at all. I have the opposite. Like I'm a person who talks themselves out of everything and is incredibly critical and thinks about every side. So, I mean, there's something kind of cool and liberating to read about somebody like that. But you're also like, would I have liked to be around this person? I don't know.
Yeah. I think also getting to know and study these personalities, you wonder how much of their persona was public and what they were like behind the scenes. You hear about people who were part of the Commodore's messengers, the kids who were swarming around L. Ron Hubbard and doing whatever he needed. And they saw him from behind the scenes and it was their job to protect him. And I've talked on the podcast about one who talked about hiding all of his pills before people came in to meet with him or photographers came in because he was supposed to be above any kind of illness if he really was a true believer. So he was different. There is this one woman who talked about having a leader who was part of this Rastafarian movement and religious movement, who actually did not have dreadlocks. And it was a hairdresser's job who was on staff full time to tie them on before he went out, and was this Rastafari leader.
I love that stuff. I love it. I don't know what to say. It's my favorite. There's a great movie called Holy Hell. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
I love Holy Hell. And my favorite part is where they have the guys whose job it is to make the fruit plate. And they're like making like the Last Supper. They're arranging the Da Vinci paintings with the strawberries. And then it turns out that it all just gets dumped into the smoothie in a blender. But they're like devotional act of putting together these things for the guru. And then it just goes in the blender. The behind the scenes stuff. It's titillating because it's like, yes, they're just like us. They're stars, and they're also just regular people who have all these flaws.
Right. Yeah. So they're just like us. And with this additional piece of really needing to be something else, I think, to others.
Yeah, bigger.
Right. Something. And what drives that is fascinating to me. I tend to think that I'm the same all the time. When I'm on the podcast and doing counseling, when I'm with my friends, with my kids, I'm the same. In fact, there's some clients who have said, you don't use the breathy therapy talk. I said, what's the breathy? Like, how are you feeling? How are you? I'm like, oh God, if I ever sound like that, please stop.
Yeah.
Just stop.
Yeah.
That's so annoying. Just why? The nurse, the how are we feeling today? Like, just say like, how's it going? You must be in pain. Do you need something? So I think there's some people who either need it, or maybe they don't know if they're enough or something. What do you think it is?
This whole idea about performance and belief that I think is so interesting, performance of self and performance of ideas, that so much of the nuts and bolts of religion or spiritual organizations occupies itself with. The myth making, the mythology, it's the TM movement, everything is going to be pastels. And we're all going to start speaking with like kind of a slightly syncopated pseudo Indian accent. For example, Maharishi has a vision of this world, and we are going to act out that world. And by acting it out, you feel like it. I mean, there's a level at which, sure, like I go home and I'm a mom. I have ideas about what being a mom is that I perform. I don't know if it makes it less sincere. There is just these modalities of being if you break it down. But then religion and the things we're talking about here, it's like that kind of ways of adapting to social situations on steroids. You're adapting to like an entirely different worldview or an entirely fantastical vision of the world.
Absolutely. I think also, and I don't know about Amy's reason for her breakdowns and how long they were, and that sounds horrible, really painful. I don't know how much of that also comes from having these split off parts of you, potentially. Here she talks about wanting to spread the gospel, but also wanting to fall in love, and public and personal all together, and they don't always go together, and one doesn't sometimes leave time for the other, and it's hard.
First of all, like as a biographer, she was kind of tricky because she doesn't really have any interior personal life record. So I would say, like, aren't there letters or postcards, anything left behind that's not from her weekly newsletter or her monthly magazine or her daily sermons? And the answer was, I mean, there were a few postcards, but largely everything that she thought she put in, she was just a transmitter. That's how she saw it. And I also heard that she didn't particularly like one-on-one conversation. She was kind of built for crowds, which is really interesting. I don't know if you've seen this, but I feel like you can think of some spiritual leaders who are like that. Like they don't want to be alone just having a cup of tea with you. Like they want to be on a stage talking, or they want to be by themselves. And with Amy, I mean, towards the end of her life, you know, I mean, these stories, she had gotten so skinny and unhealthy that she was being carried She would preach at the pulpit. She would be covered in sweat, like after an hour. You know, she'd give it her all. She would be carried off by her son through the back door in her dress to her little apartment in the back, where she would carb load. She would eat big bowls of ice cream to cool down and get energy really quickly, and often kept company by her spider monkey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there you go.
Not being able to handle that one-on-one, those kinds of conversations, I mean, certainly that's going to make a relationship harder. But I wonder also how much of that has to do with not really wanting to spend time just on chit chat. That when I think you feel you have a message for the world and it's time dated, I have to get this across to people and there's an urgency, then you don't want to talk about the weather or the Dodgers or whatever else. It feels like a waste. And the reason I say that is not that I talk to cult leaders about that, but I've talked to people raised in cults, got involved in cults, and they say, I don't know how to do small talk. We never did it. Everything was of the utmost importance, and you had to talk about saving of the planet, not anything else.
Yeah, I think it's especially Scientology, right? They're very militaristic almost. I think he had a lot of militaristic feel to things. This is maybe a can of worms, but this makes me think of, I interviewed David Lynch a number of times, who became like a big evangelist for the TM, the practice of transcendental meditation. And his switch from being a person who just had meditated for decades on his own to becoming an evangelist, so to speak, is that he went to the Netherlands in the early aughts. And for this, what was called the $1 million course, the Enlightenment course, where you went and you were going to get to spend a month with Maharishi. And he got there and Maharishi was upstairs and the people who had paid were all downstairs, and Maharishi was communicating via telephone or video conference. He was not coming into the room. I remember David saying, like, yeah, it was a disappointment, but then I got it and we felt his power. I mean, that's how I grew up, with this very Wizard of Ozzy relationship. Maharishi like completely organized our community and our thoughts and like our rules, you know, the food we ate, the colors we wore, like our daily schedule. But he only communicated through teleconferences that we would have at these big celebrations. I think he came into town once in the years that I lived there. There's always this idea that our energy was not good for him. They're so pure that they can't be around us. Some of that is the language that you hear, that they're too enlightened to be around us. So I think there's some of that happening too with Amy, where she's become so intense and so isolated that she can't have these casual relationships. And a lot of her personal relationships fell apart in the later years.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying, yeah, not knowing, and I'll be reading your book to find out more, but still there is something interesting about how that personality also usually, L. Ron Hubbard, just have a lot of different lives.
And extreme isolation. I mean, you think about the way that he died. I mean, what people have said about those last, when he was living on that ranch, like everything had to be painted a certain color. His fingernails had gotten very long. It was like extreme fanatical Howard Hughes control.
Yeah. Going back to the David Lynch story, so I know he passed, and I'm sure after you spent a lot of time talking to him, that probably impacted you. So I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he says that he spent $1 million to go there and was expecting, probably as most people would, to spend time, and that the leader stayed upstairs when everyone else was downstairs. The part that got me when you were talking about it was when he said it kind of bothered him at first, but then he got it. And I'm thinking, that's fascinating. Because he got what?
Yeah.
He was fed what? Or he justified it, or he had to justify it in his mind. Like, there are a lot of people who get it, but then years later, or after they've left, they're thinking, I actually don't know what I got, how I made it make sense to me or how they made it make sense. Because I find in those moments, someone's first response to something like that is the most accurate. And then the second one is what they've been fed with or what they feed themselves with to make it okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things I think is the most interesting is the way that these leaders can turn instinct against you. I was obsessed with the NXIVM story, for example. And what I thought was so fascinating, and I will tell you that I've been working on this novel that goes into this because it's the most interesting thing to me, is the way that Keith Raniere would weaponize these women and their sense of who they were to stop them. He had all these things about like, well, women are jealous and emotional and reactive. So if you feel any of those things, that's you being too female, the negative side of being female. So don't do that. So when I'm sleeping with you and then I sleep with like three other people, or I start to withhold food from you, or I ask you to join like a secret branding society, and you have an instinct that that is not feels good, that's because you are being like a bad female. There was all this language in NXIVM around badass women who weren't like that. That to me is the perfect mindfuck to have this guy, everyone's watching play volleyball, little guy who's told everyone he's the smartest guy in the world, and all these kind of impressive, beautiful women who he makes feel so bad about their natural instincts that they are kind of defanged. And as soon as they feel some kind of pushback on things he says, he's categorized that. They actually, I think, called it even in training something called like the NXIVM flip. I believe that's what it was, where it's this thing where it's like, before you're critical, oh, you're being critical, take a look at that criticism. And so you're, yeah, I think defanged is the right word for it. It takes away your power.
Yeah, it takes away your power. It takes away your resistance, your ability to have any safeguards, your ability to follow your own instinct, which is something that takes a while for people to get back, or people born and raised in cults, it takes a while for them to develop that and to trust it. They don't hear themselves. They've been taught not to, especially if it's at all under the rubric of saying no. So that's interesting. That's very interesting. Well, it's like Scientology with the reactive mind. That's the thing that's bad and you have to ignore that. But no, that's your safety net.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me, before we get into where people can find you in your books and all of it, was there anything else that you wanted to make sure to let us know about that's on your mind when it comes to these subjects?
Well, I would just say what we were just talking about, I think, is interesting with Amy's story is you see some of her trying to navigate. I mean, this is like a whole separate conversation about women and religion, but her trying to navigate her right and power to do what she was doing while being inside a fundamentalist belief system. And I think there is a lot in fundamentalist Christianity that disempowers women. So that's one of the like kind of incredible things about her life and the way that she lived it is you also see somebody really trying to navigate and manipulate a belief system that didn't allow her a lot of power. This is where I'm like, of course you could, you know, people have called her a grifter, the P.T. Barnum of religion, a huckster, a hoax. And on the other hand, you're like, she used everything that she could think of to have power in a religious framework where she wasn't really supposed to have any. So I think that's worth looking at and admiring some of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. And so thank you. Thank you for our conversation today. It is so interesting to get into these personalities and understand them and also understand not only about what makes them tick, but when they lived and how that helps us understand them and what was happening socially around them and the language and the awe and all of it. I mean, it's really, we went a lot of different directions. Where can people find you and your book?
Thank you, Rachel. I really love this doc. I might need to make a follow-up therapy appointment with you. I was like, oh, I have that problem where you can't listen to yourself. So TBD. But yes, my book is on Amazon and bookstores, wherever you like to buy books. I will be at Book Soup in Los Angeles on April 22nd. I will be in Chicago and New York and Boston and Denver. So yes, lots of book tour things that I'm really excited about. And it was just excerpted yesterday in Vanity Fair. So you can check that out.
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow. So good to talk to you. And yes, you know how to find me.
Okay. Yeah.
Even just about women and religion and female leaders, and feel like that is a whole other conversation we could have at some point.
I would love that.
Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you, Rachel.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Claire Hoffman for coming on the show today, for talking about this person who was sort of a part of my Angeleno history growing up here in LA. Amy Semple McPherson and the Four Square Church is sort of legendary here, and it has this mystique, and she was always this character. There are things that we've come to notice here in Los Angeles, things that we love to be able to see, things that bring us to our history here and tie us as a community. For people in LA, you'll probably relate when I say that the other day I had an Angeline sighting. And Angeline is this actress and someone who is famous for being famous, who is on billboards in Los Angeles. And she drives a very bubblegum pink sports car and has a look of kind of a 50s, 40s pinup girl. She actually is an interesting character. And if you look her up, you'll find that her family actually has a Holocaust history, which adds a lot of, I think, depth to who people think she is. These are the kinds of people who we see sometimes around here, people we hear about, but Amy Semple McPherson is someone who really had this mystery all around her. She was sort of shrouded in it. What I find so interesting about her is the sadness, actually, that I feel when hearing about her, when hearing about personalities like hers. Claire talks about how much she was in need of wanting to spread the gospel, but also how much she was in need of falling in love and just being loved and having a connection and knowing that she mattered to someone. And so here you have someone who is bright and capable and smart and can memorize a lot so that she can just speak extemporaneously and offer insights and quote the Bible. And at the same time, she, I think, just desperately needed to know that she mattered. And that comes from an empty place, usually. That comes from a needy place. That comes from a place that people don't want to admit that they have when they are these public figures. And that's also what can start to really eat away at them as they get older, but also as their life doesn't pan out the way they had hoped or the way they needed, with having people in it, with having healthy relationships in it. It is super sad to hear this quote of hers, which was, "If you love me, you'll believe me." But it's also something that people do think. If you love me, then honor me by taking in what I say as the truth. But it's also true that that's not the way the truth works. It doesn't become more true because you love the person who's saying it, and it doesn't become less true because you don't love the person who's saying it. They operate independently. But people like her will see that as a sign of a lack of affection, of a lack of connection, that's also saying to people, I will not be able to handle if you don't believe me. It will probably make me crumble or make me angry, but either way, I'm going to have a big reaction to it because it's not within my system to be able to tolerate those moments. People who are confident, people who are quietly confident, actually don't have a life like Amy Semple McPherson. But people who are confident can say, you know what, actually, I don't know if I care if you agree with me or not, or if you believe what I'm saying or not. Yes, it would be a lot more fun or a lot more satisfying, feel a lot better if you do believe me, but I don't need it in order to survive. But some people do. Some people will use that in their relationships. Some people will take this in a big way and start a huge church and use their charisma to bring a lot of people into the fold and have a huge flock. But just knowing too that she needed to develop some drama, I think, to keep a focus on her. We probably all know people in our lives who do that, who have done that, who have created a scene so that they're the ones talked about. I know that every once in a while, I'll go to an event. And after the event, it could be a wedding, could be a funeral, could be anything. After the event, the person whose event it was is not the one who's talked about like, oh, wasn't that a lovely thing? Or, oh, I'll so miss this person who's passed. But instead, we're talking about the guest or the relative who felt slighted and wasn't in all the pictures or was put in a different row than they were expecting behind other people. That becomes the topic. And they, I think, feel like that moment dethroned them in some way, and other people may have mattered more. And so they need to grab the attention back. And it is sad. It's like being a child inside, and you don't notice that people who have huge congregations, who are making a big living, who are living a big life, actually can still be children inside. Thank you so much for this insight into this person and this personality. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.